Oh, if I had a wish, it would be that the microphones went on about 40 seconds ago. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A delight to have you on a rather dank, dismal day. It's raining or snowing or sleeting or something, probably where you are, but it is, and it's cold, but it's very nice, and our conversation will keep you warm.
Maybe.
Let me introduce everybody, then we'll welcome you to the program and give you the address so you can check in. And we didn't get many letters yesterday because it was a holiday. Today's not a holiday, so you have no excuses, so you can inundate us. We're ready to take it. We welcome J.P. Miller to the program. He is the Empire Report. Is J.P. Miller. J.P. Miller is the Empire Report and vice versa. Good morning, sir. How
are
you?
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful to have you here, as always. Mike Spain is here. He is Times Union's associate editor. There we go. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Very nice to
I just want to say that I heard Alan's golden-throated voice the other night at Capitol Steps, where he joined the troop.
I did.
In a parody of the old Neil Sedaka song, Calendar Girls, but it was about Calendar Brett Kavanaugh. It was pretty good.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Well, that was excellent.
The best part is we have that on tape, which is great. That is good. We'll have to break that out. We are thrilled because she's been traveling the world, going to Harvard and then Botswana, and now she's back here in Albany, and we're thrilled. Fran Berman is the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and Faculty Associate at the Bergman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.
Wow.
Fran, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Wow.
Nice to be back.
It is wonderful to have you back. So what have you been up to?
Oh, my gosh.
What brought you to Botswana? Was that just fun or was that work?
It was work, but I also had fun doing work. I was there for a conference for a group called the Research Data Alliance, which is an international data group, which builds the infrastructure needed to do research and use data well.
Whoa.
And it was really exciting. We had about 800 people at the conference. Over 400 of them, maybe close to 500 of them, were from Africa. So there were lots of new colleagues and lots of things to catch up on, and it was really successful.
Was Botswana, did that just happen to be the place to meet, or are they at the forefront of some of this work?
Well, the interesting thing is this is an organization that has almost 8,000 members from 135 plus countries. So we have meetings twice a year. And they go all around the world. We've been to Europe. We've been to Japan. This is our first time in Africa. We've been to the U.S. several times. We've been to Canada. And so it was Africa's turn. It was the first time we were there. And we coupled with another organization, actually another two organizations, and really made it what was called International Data Week. So we really attracted a lot of people from all parts of the spectrum.
But wait, do you have an official title in that group?
I actually do. I'm one of the founders of that group, and I am currently the lead of the U.S. part of that group and also on the International Council.
Every time you come in here, I'm more impressed, and I don't think there's any room more to be impressed. It's incredible.
Well, thank you very much, Alan.
Well, thank you for being here and for coming back. We appreciate it. Alan Chartak is here as well. Good morning, Alan. How are you, sir?
October. You see, that's part of the calendar.
Calendar.
Yeah.
It's going to do. Jump in whenever you want, JP.
And by the way, if you were there, you get a copy.
That's right. That's what I say. We have it on tape. Yeah.
Everybody
was a full house.
It was a full house, and it was rainy and awful and boy, people turned out.
You know, we've done that with, I think that was the fifth year we've done it, and it's always sold out, and it's always a big event. We're thrilled to have, our friends, the Capitol Steps, but that everybody supports us and does that is wonderful. So, all right, let us get into what is happening in the world, because there is a lot of stuff to talk about, and if depending on your political persuasion, there was some good news if you were a Democrat yesterday, because they finally called the race in Arizona. Kristen Sinema, is am I pronouncing that right? Sinema?
I've heard it pronounced cinema.
Cinema, like with movie. A C.
Yeah,
Kristen Sinema was declared the winner in the Arizona Senate race, a groundbreaking victory in the race, defeating her Republican opponent after waging a campaign in which she embraced solidly centrist positions. Her victory was over Martha McSally, a Republican congresswoman and former Air Force pilot, marks the first Democratic triumph since 1976 in a battle for an open Senate seat in Arizona. This is Jeff Flake's seat, you may remember. Sinema's victory guarantees the Democrats at least 47 Senate seats. We'll get into this in a few moments. But there are still two undecided, one in Mississippi where there will be a runoff, and the other, of course, in Florida where there is currently a recount. Yes, with a deadline that is on Thursday. And there is, of course, some question, too, about, it seems when you look at it, even if all of the votes were to go for the Democratic candidate, that they still would not have enough to overcome the margin. However, the recount is on, and we will see what happens there. So let us talk about Arizona. Hard to believe. Here we have the state of Arizona that went Democratic. Alan.
Well, it's extraordinary. First woman, great. 30 years, that's great.
Openly bisexual.
Openly bisexual, that's great. It is a mark of anti-Trumpism, if there ever was one. You got Flake getting out, and it's clear he has nothing good to say about the president these days. And McCain, who of course offered some, who offered some very tough words on the president from time to time, and so there goes Arizona. That's a good sign to me.
42 years old, and was born poor. Was homeless as a child. Quite a story.
She was once the spokeswoman for the Green Party.
Yes.
And when she became a Democratic elected member of Congress, she was criticized by a lot of progressives because they said she sided with Trump on some things, or you could say she reached across the aisle, whichever way you want to portray that. She's pretty moderate, pretty middle of the road. She's talking about reaching across the aisle as a senator. And I was telling JP and Fran a little while ago this morning, her opponent, Martha McSally, another member of Congress, I guess.
And a great name. Let's face it. Martha McSally. A great name. It doesn't get any more illiterate.
No, Martha McSally.
It almost sounds like a character in Mr. Rogers.
I was going to say out of like Monsters, Inc., but sure,
okay,
go
sure.
ahead.
Anyway, did a little self-video that she posted that they played on one of the morning news shows, and she was so gracious. She said, I think Arizona is a great state, and I look forward in doing anything I can to work with Ms. Sinema, Senator Sinema now. And I wished it had turned out differently, but, we're going to work together, and it was a great race. And it was an example of civility.
It was.
So
I
love that. I think it's so important to kind of get back to that kind of response.
But isn't it sad that, we're pointing it out as
an anomaly?
An anomaly, right.
Well,
oh, my God, she was nice to her opponent.
Go with it.
But
go
we'll take what we can get.
Well, there
right?
may have been a reason.
Two women.
There may have been a reason because NPR announced this morning that the guy who's a placeholder for McCain is going to get out. And that the governor gets to make that appointment, and that appointment may well be McSally. So it made sense for her
to be gracious.
To be gracious.
Yeah.
But,
Although,
just because it's strategic doesn't mean it's a bad thing to do. So
that comes from a different place than I live.
Yeah.
So, I'm really glad.
Yeah.
I think that's a different worldview than perhaps Dr. Chartok has.
It is a strategic thing to do. But I think Sinema's an interesting person. I mean, as you said, she's former homeless. She's got a master's in social work. She's got a law degree. She has a PhD in social justice. Whoa. She worked on Ralph Nader's campaign. She was a Green Party person. I mean, this is a really different profile than you're seeing. And, what I've read about the voters in Arizona is they really focused on, you know, the dissatisfaction that was there with the budget cuts, the unease over immigration. Arizona is really a big state, which is feeling the impact of that. And then there was a big drive to register more Latinos, and that's about a third of the population of Arizona. So, you know, we might be seeing some really interesting consequences of, you know, everything that's been going on.
I mean, don't you think also, Alan mentioned this about having to do with the Trump factor, of course, but immigration was huge in this race,
yeah.
Obviously with being Arizona. And so to have the Democratic senator voted seems to me to also speak volumes about that issue, at least for people who live on the border.
Yeah, they said that the Hispanic community was, or just Arizonans, were upset about the way that immigrants were being treated, and that families were being separated, and children were being kept from their families, and that actually backfired on the administration.
Well, but you know, I was watching another place, Will K. Morning Joe, this morning, and they had turnout figures. And the turnout among Hispanics was not terrific.
Huh.
In Arizona?
No, period.
Oh, period. Okay.
Period. Right. White turnout was higher.
Yeah, and they expected, I guess it was Florida, because they expected more Puerto Rican turnout, because a lot of people had immigrated from, or immigrated is the wrong word, or moved from Puerto Rico to Florida, and it was a little disappointing.
Although
did they talk about Arizona? Sorry, JP.
I do think in Arizona they've credited a lot of the Latino vote in helping get her over the top in a traditionally red state. And I was sad to see Claire McCaskill lose because she's a moderate voice in the Senate. I think with how things are in Washington, it's good to have moderate voices. So I'm really excited to have this senator in there. Good to have moderate voices both on the Republican side and Democrat side.
JP, I stand corrected. I thank you for that.
Okay.
You're welcome.
We're all here to help each other. So that are we out?
Yeah.
So there is the Arizona Senate race, and then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the recount battle in Florida. This has gotten ugly. Acrimony in the Florida recount battle deepened Monday as Senator Bill Nelson called on his Republican opponent Rick Scott to recuse himself from overseeing the process, and as President Trump alleged without evidence that ballots were missing or forged, As local officials scrambled to meet Thursday's machine recount deadline, can somebody tell me about why there's a deadline on Thursday? If it takes a little bit longer, isn't it better to get it right than is it arbitrary, or is there a reason for that deadline?
Well, I think that's what they imposed. Perhaps it was intended, I don't know, to prevent a debacle like 2000, the Florida election.
They went on and on and on. And on.
But, you know, I looked it up today. When Al Franken ran for the Senate in Minnesota in 2008, that was 8 months long, the recounts and the court battles and the back and forth and the re-recounts. Norm Coleman lost by a couple of hundred votes in the end. And Franken was not seated in office until July 7th of that year. So, I mean, it's better. I mentioned that because that President Trump tweeted that an honest vote count is no longer possible. The ballots are all in and they've been infected. So we just shouldn't make Governor Scott the senator.
So just throw those votes away.
Can I just say that, in all honesty, that is one of the most disgusting things that this man has done. And I said it yesterday and I say it again. I mean, the one thing that this country really is known for is a peaceful and easy transference of power, democratic transference of power. And for this so-called president to be undermining all of that is really disgusting.
Right. And they should just take as long as necessary. I mean, you need to, you know, right. Just for this. I mean, you should be pressured to get it done as quickly as possible, but it should be done right. And that's what happened in Minnesota.
The president said that he has more votes. He should be the winner. And I thought, I know somebody else who had more votes.
They do not have an electoral system within the state of Florida.
And also, what's the deal about him overseeing all of this? You know, this is what conflict of interest is all about. He has a conflict of interest.
That's
should
right.
Be his, should be his middle name.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he should recuse himself, is what his opponent is asking, Senator Nelson is asking.
I'm about to get into a huge question, so I won't do it with a minute to go for break. But I'm hoping, Fran, maybe after the break, you could get into some what is up with the technology having to do with the machines in Florida. I thought we fixed that. And it's just interesting to me that it's the same two counties that we had the problems with in 2000. And my reading in the New York Times was that the construction of the ballot, meaning the paper that you put in the machine, it's very easy to make a mistake on. And I'm just curious as to why in this country we can't get that right.
Wow.
So ponder that.
Okay.
All right. And if you want us to forget about it, we can just forget. I even asked that question during the break. But in the meantime, we'll be back in just a moment. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. So when last we were speaking, we were talking to Fran Berman, and we were talking about election, the actual voting machines and what's going on, of course, the recount in Florida. And I think, Fran, I mean, we could certainly talk about what's happening in Florida and what the issue is there, because there's now a hand recount to look over what the machines perhaps missed. But I guess the larger question really is, don't we have the technology in this country, not just for Florida, but for all of our states, to have a system and to have machines that can fairly, accurately, and securely tally votes?
Okay, so I'll tell you my understanding, and let me start with the question that you started with, which is, in Florida, what's the issue? And my understanding about Florida is that if you do a machine recount, which is what they're doing now, you basically have optical scanners that are looking at ballots and then trying to count those. And the algorithm behind the optical scanner can have problems. And it has problems in particular with undervotes and overvotes. So there's a speck on the ballot and it thinks you voted more than one time, or it didn't register somehow how people voted. And so if that gets within a small enough tolerance, then they have to do a manual recount. So this is, for all you non-fans of science out there, this is a place where you have human beings who can actually look at those small, sophisticated approaches and sort of do better than the machines. So that's, I think, what's going on in Florida. And readers, if you know more than that, please feel free to write in. Listeners. I hope you're reading, too.
Are there any Chads still on the paper ballots?
I don't think so.
Good.
The one thing I would say about Florida is at least they have experience in having a very high stakes recount. And so you'd think that over that time that they have best practices.
I guess that is a plus.
And the other thing is I did think that this was a new low for Trump to politicize vote counting.
Yeah.
This is something that we should simply have, you know, good intention members from both Republicans and Democrats sitting there counting ballots, and whoever wins wins. And I think it's a scary identifier for what might happen if there's ever a close count in one of his elections, he would do. It's just disgusting.
Yeah. And can we really believe that there aren't still politicians in every state in this country who turn off voters one way or another from voting? In other words, provisional voters, for example, and they say, oh, no, we don't have you registered, so we're going to allow you to provisionally vote. And then they say, when it's time to count those provisional votes, oh, no, you can't vote because you were provisional. So that's crazy. And federal judges have gotten involved in that.
Yeah.
And one wonders, because there's always a way of, you know, from the beginning, the old ward healers used to keep lead under their fingernails.
This is a big time for voting rights. You would have thought we would have put that to bed, but we didn't.
Really?
But I would have thought we would have put that to bed.
Well, because you're a good person. But
thank
the,
you.
But the bad people have
stop that.
But the bad people have prevailed so often. You know, they have made it clear that we don't want people voting, and we know who the people we don't want voting, right. You know, are, and all that. So.
Yeah. Well, it's effective. I mean, don't you think it's effective when they give you a hard time? Those occasional voters, the ones who could make the difference, occasionally don't come out.
And they don't want them out. Yeah.
And just to be respectful of Joe and to answer his question, voting machines are really interesting. And we do have the technologies to do it right, but many of the voting machines out there don't do it right. And think about it. Anything connected to the internet can be hacked, and voting machines need to be updated. They need to be programmed. You need to have a new ballot, you know, every time you have a new election. And these are things that can be connected to the internet. They can be hacked, so we need to make them secure, and we need to make sure that all of the surfaces of insecurity are really dealt with. So when you're thinking about voting machines, you really need to think about making something that's efficient for the voters, user-friendly, that's robust, and that deals with the catastrophic scenario well. And the catastrophic scenario is hacking or manipulation of some sort. So, yes, we have the technology for that, but many of the voting machines out there don't have those components of the technology, especially the catastrophic scenario.
And so why not? I mean, in other words, we have always known, I don't want to be seen as a conspiratorialist because I'm not. But, you know, garbage in, garbage out. Somebody's got to program all of this. Somebody's got to design this stuff. There's got to be a reason that we don't have the latest
money.
And the best.
These things are expensive. And the other thing is, you know, one of the things in a catastrophic scenario situation is you want a paper ballot backup, right? So you want to create something so you can verify and validate things. And, you know, all of that is new technology, it's infrastructure for a state, and it's expensive to put in.
And there are also very smart people that say, okay, we're going to do all of our voting on our cell phones, our mobile apps. This is how everything is going to be done. And then there are also very smart people that say, no, we need a paper record. So just that debate itself is tough. And, of course, we all have secret ballots. No one wants people to know how they're voting, and so you can't match that up to your name or your cell phone how you voted.
I understand Fran's point about the money, although I want to go to Alan because I was just wondering I think my thought was that it was something a little more nefarious than that, is that the reason they don't do it is because they don't really want they want to be able to manipulate it more than they could if it were
well, I certainly
pure.
Think based on the fact that so many states have ways of turning people away from the polls or getting them not to vote, that if you transfer that intention to the way in which we vote, to the mechanism in which we vote, one has to at least suspect that there's a possibility there.
Well, I, from experience in New York City compared to voting upstate, voting in New York City was always a problem, always a long line. My wife was in line with me. They wanted to give her a provisional ballot. She said, I don't want a provisional ballot. And it turns out she was at the wrong table. I mean, what happens in New York City and what I experienced in upstate is it's a real shame and a disenfranchisement of the people in New York City, which are historically lower income.
As always, you make a good point.
Well, I vote in Troy, and there's almost never anyone there. And they're always delighted to see whoever comes to vote because now there's something to do. That's kind of a really sad statement.
Yeah.
Well, we have some letters. Let's do those, and then we'll move on.
It's interesting. There aren't that many letters, and I suspect that's because we have Dr. Berman with us today, who is so smart that people are just listening to the panel.
They're glued.
Yeah. Okay, and let's see here. I have to put my glasses on. You don't mind if I do that to you?
No, please. No? Okay. Please do that. Thank whatever you need.
Yeah. I always think it's very impressive when somebody takes their glasses on and off, and, you know, it's throws them
Bill down. Bill Clinton used to do that during his speeches. It looked so cool when
it
you
does.
Would take them off and talk and then put them back on.
Sure. Throw them down on the podium.
Not good for radio, but good on TV.
Know, okay. Well, I'm certainly glad that Cinema One in Arizona, says Bill, but McSally's concession video with her dog and her grace has got to be the highlight of this election. Perhaps the pugnacious, divisive, and crass influence of Trump is coming to an end. We can only hope and support civility when and where it occurs. You know, that is such an interesting letter when you think about it for a second, because there are all these Republicans who really hate Trump's guts. There's no two ways about it. It leaks out. We hear about it. So what is fascinating to me is there's always the possibility of a tipping point coming for some of these people when they say, the hell with it. I'm going to say what I mean. And people will either come along or they won't. And I'll be a leader as opposed to a sheepish follower. And I've been waiting for that for a long time with the Republican senators, especially. I look at the results of, there was a very interesting article in today's paper, your paper, Mike. You own it, which is the...
I buy it every day.
I
own my copy.
They mean you buy it?
Which is the article on John Faso.
Yeah.
And how unhappy he was.
That was a Chris Churchill column.
Yeah, Chris Churchill column. And the results, and, Faso basically blaming the press, for what happened. And then the president, in characteristic fashion, coming out and blaming Faso for not being loyal enough.
But Faso, interestingly, feels that at least expressed the opinion that had he embraced Trump, it would have been even more difficult to win that
without
election.
Question. Yeah. I have no question about that at all. So for Trump to come out and do what he did is extraordinary. And the classless, lowlife way in which he did it is just unbelievable.
Well, and let's give some credit to the Delgado people who really killed themselves to make this happen. I mean, including some of our beloved commentators here. I mean, that was fantastic.
I was I had lunch yesterday with a wonderful, I don't want to use her name because I don't think it's fair, academic colleague who said that for the last couple of months, all she did was to work for the Delgado campaign.
Yeah.
And to make sure that this happened. The energy which was there is extraordinary.
Right.
Yes. So anyway, so that's from Bill. And then from Bob. Here's my prediction. If Nelson wins, McConnell will refuse to seat him, claiming fraud. First of all, I don't think Nelson's going to win.
It seems unlikely.
I think things are too far behind. Mm. And if he did win, I doubt, well, who woulda, coulda, shmoulda? We don't really know. I don't think that McConnell would have dared, but we'll never
Although
know.
Although his point in the tweet that he responded to President Trump is, what are you worried about when it comes to the recall? You do wonder if they're making such a big deal of what they're concerned about.
Hmm. Could you explain that just a little bit more?
So the Democrat who is behind the president is talking about the forged and missing ballots and all that.
Sure.
And in response, the Democrat who's the Democrat?
Nelson.
Nelson tweeted back to the president and said, "What are you worried about?"
Yeah.
What are you worried about? If your person has more votes, then fine. But what are you worried about?
Yeah.
What are you running from? And I don't know. That seems a fair point. I don't know what they know, but it does seem. But when you look at the numbers that he has to overcome to win,
12,000 votes.
It seems fairly monumental.
You know, I'm so old, so much older than all of you in this room, probably older than all of you put together. And I what are you laughing? I remember the failure of the Congress to seat Adam Clayton Powell.
Oh, my
the
God,
black
you
congressman.
Are old.
That's what I'm telling you.
He was the Harlem congressman who had been convicted of a crime.
He was. What was her name? Esther James, I think. He accused.
Well, you
of,
are old.
He accused her of being
going back into the files.
Wagner's bag person.
This was all in black and white when it happened.
Yeah, it was indeed. And the Supreme Court of the United States said, seat him. And I think that would have happened here, too. I mean, it was just
That'll be an issue with Christopher Collins, the member of Congress from the Buffalo area, who was reelected, even though he's facing a federal indictment for inside trading. And if he's convicted of that, will he have to sit then?
I bet they'll seat him. Yep. I mean, I think that the last thing they want to do is to be seen as cheap shot, or the Democrats, now that they've taken control, to be seen as cheap shot artists. And also, in the back of every one of their minds is, there but for the grace of God goes I.
Right.
Yeah. So
ultimately,
there's that.
All right. Let's hold there, Alan. We have more letters coming through the door. We have more letters in your hand. We will get to all of that when we return after this short break. Right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you all with us. J.P. Miller is here, Fran Berman, Mike Spain, and Alan Chartok, who has a fistful of letters, and he'll read some now.
Hello, panel. Thanks for your good work. What is happening with Stacey Abrams and the Georgia race? And that's from Barb. She's behind also. It's hard to believe that she'll be able to make it up.
And she has yet to concede, and a federal judge has ruled to protect provisional ballots, right?
Once
and,
again.
They will review those provisional ballots. That's where it is right now.
And in Georgia, they take those provisional ballots very seriously.
Well, and also, a number of those ballots, from my understanding, and correct me, panel, if I'm wrong on this, but my understanding was a great deal of those ballots were coming from the city of Atlanta.
Yeah, makes sense.
In which was expected to heavily favor Stacey Abrams. So,
yeah. How many votes? Is it 20,000, something like that?
It's a big number. I thought maybe it seems more than that. It does. It's almost 2 or 3 I think it's 2 or 3 percentage points, if I'm not.
Is that where, though, if it's within a certain range,
you
there
have
has
to, have
to
a
be
runoff?
A runoff?
Yeah.
That would, so it doesn't mean that she has to make up all of the
votes.
Was
there a third candidate in that one? Wasn't that the one where there's a third candidate and the runoff would happen if, you know, she does better? I don't know.
Yeah, so there's some great graphs on this, by the way, in the New York Times.
Fantastic.
They sort of show, like, when you get in the zone for which you have to do something special, a recount or, you know,
so,
something like that.
A runoff.
In this case, Kemp had 50.2%. Abrams had 48.7% as of this morning. More than 3.9 million votes were cast in the election. Abrams would need to acquire more than 20,000 additional votes to force a runoff. Meanwhile, there are 21,190 provisional ballots that were cast in the midterm. So
you'd have to get 20,000.
You would have to get 20,000 of the 21,000. Now,
I mean,
this
statistically
is
statistically unlikely.
Infeasible.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
you're the expert.
Although, if unfeasible. You're in the race, you can understand why you wouldn't concede until those votes are counted. Yes?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, at least that's the way I'm sure Mr. Kemp thinks about it very differently, but there you go.
Going on.
Yes.
Oh, did Kemp just finally do the right thing and disqualify himself?
Yes, last Friday he did.
I think he did, yeah.
Yes.
All right. And so Carol says, one major problem is 26,000 vote discrepancy between the number of votes for governor and the vote for Senate, apparently due to putting the Senate selection below a half page of description on the 5-page ballot. Broward County, I believe. Now, Broward County, to be fair, even though, you know, I tend to be a little bit more liberal in these things than others, has had a history of having some real problems.
Palm Beach County and Broward County both were the problem children of the 2000 election.
Yeah, yeah.
But that letter is really interesting because there's been a lot of studies that have shown that ordering matters. You know, the way you present the information matters. And so, you know, it's another thing to throw into the pot of, you know, voting is how do you present the information in such a way that it minimizes that?
In some cases, New York had propositions that were on the back of the paper ballots. And there was a campaign saying, turn it over, because people completely missed them. It wasn't this time.
And also, depending on the number of votes you get, your position on the ballot the next time, vote for governor, your position on the ballot the next time is determined. Huh. And we know, quite right, rightly, gang, that, you know, being A or B matters.
Yeah, vote row A used to be the symbol of vote row B would be the, you know, campaign. That matters. Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. Thank you, Carol. And then we heard from Martha in Suffield, Connecticut. Hello, my daily dose of sanity. That's you, she says. Get it? Hello. That's to the panel. My daily dose of sanity. That's you, she says. One, Okay, I understand it, but maybe my colleagues don't. One, before the elections, you spoke often of the gerrymandered districts all over the country. I have not heard that mentioned in any of the post-election discussions. Well, then you haven't been listening carefully, because, boy, we have talked about gerrymandering. Should Democrats be even more enthusiastic because of so many wins in spite of gerrymandered districts? And two, whatever happened to Rosemary? Okay, let's deal with number one first. Sure, the more state legislatures you take, the more governorships you take, the more that you will interfere with the ability of the other party to gerrymander, right? So we got that right. And since the Democrats have done quite well in this election in those areas, you know, it would put a little bit of a damper on the Republican efforts, which they have done very successfully to take state legislatures and governor seats.
Which is how the 2016 election ended up with the electoral victory for Trump, but the plurality for Hillary Clinton. You know, it was just where the votes were, and it matters.
Would you think that now that the Democrats are taking over, they'll just draw fair districts, or might they engage in gerrymandering themselves?
I have, in the 1,000 years that I have been doing this job, I have always asked the people in the minority party, for example, one James Tedesco, when you get into the majority, will you do unto them as they've done unto you? And always I've been assured, and this is the one that always gets me, they always say, I would like to think not.
Yeah.
By the way, I just have to throw in the geek comment here. This is a problem that is solvable by math. There are a lot of people who looked at redistricting. You can apply, you know, various reliable, non-biased algorithms to it. There's different ways
algorithms,
of doing it.
There you go again.
You can do this by math. I understand why we don't do this by math.
Right.
I think we should do this by math.
Well, you can. And in fact, in New York State, remember that the Democrats are allowed to gerrymander their own districts in the assembly, and they do with great largesse. And the Republicans, up to now, have always been able to do the way they've stayed in office is to be able to go to the great computer and say, draw me districts where we can't lose, right?
Right.
But when it came to the Congress, they couldn't agree. And so what happened is a federal judge had to draw the districts. Now, when you see that and you had so-called fair fight districts in the congressional races because they weren't gerrymandered. And that, my friends, may be why John Faso lost that race, if you think about it.
And it's important to note, to add to Fran's comment, is that when the federal judge went to do that, it was done in minutes because of computer programs. It's fairly easy.
And there's different approaches, you know, but they all give you sort of legit districts.
Yes,
now,
the really
interesting question, you'd be interested in this question, I'm sure, Alan, is like, once you get mass-generated districts, does it really change anything? And that's a whole other question.
Of course it changes things. I mean, if you have so-called fair fight districts, but what the whole politics of gerrymandering is you take all the people that you don't want to win, all the Democrats in the case of the state Senate, and you shove them into one, you pack them. That's the right word. Thanks, JP.
You're welcome.
You pack them into one district so that they're not spread out over several districts where they can win.
To the second part of the listener's question, Rosemary Armeo, she left us about a year and a half ago to go to Jordan to work with investigative reporters, young investigative reporters, to help them learn how to report on oppressive regimes. We are very pleased to say that she will be back for the winter recess and will be joining us most days during that, right after Christmas Day.
But also to add to that, I have to say that because of the danger to reporters in those areas in the world where she has been, it's probably sometimes better to put your identity under a bushel basket so that, you know, people won't be looking for you. Am I wrong to say that?
I don't know. I don't know what you're referring to, but that's okay.
Well, she has to keep a low profile in a country and, like.
Oh,
Georgia.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
That's right. Okay, and that's from Martha. Thanks, Martha. And then Chef Rick Orlando. Good morning, panel. On the soggy day, I have an idea. I know states' rights are extremely important. However, federal elections affect us all. How hard would it be to create a set of federal laws for elections for Senate, Congress, and the president to supersede state laws? Do you hear the dark music in the background, everybody? Let the stage to their account your fingers thing for the local elections, but for the federal laws have one style ballot, one method of accounting, and one will define fail-safe for elections that are disputer close. Just wondering, and I know Rick Orlando is a much better chef than he is a typist.
I love your restaurant. Just saying, I love your restaurant.
I see you're getting a shot there, Rick.
So, anyway, in answer to his, do we have to go?
We do.
Okay.
But you can answer his question, and then we have to go.
To answer his question, right now you had a president, a House, and a Senate, and they were all run by the Republicans. And if they had to write the laws, do you really think that would be a good idea? For all the states?
It'd be a new world.
It would be a new world. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll...
Dvorak.
Well, New World was his restaurant. Mm-hmm. It was Rick's restaurant, right?
And Dvorak.
Yeah, and Dvorak. Hey, Ray, you ready for us to... Do you think we should end this? We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Oh, what a discussion we've been having. Mm. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Fran Berman, and J.P. Miller. We go back to the letters, and then we'll go back to the topics, and then we'll figure out where we are then.
Okay. So Kevin says, Kevin and Sandy both say they wrote it together, which I like. Trump claimed the French were starting to learn German before we saved them in World War II. Hard as it may be for him to understand, they already spoke German and other languages on their own.
Took two people to write that letter.
And Melinda said, Trump's excuse for missing, skipping the ceremony in France to commemorate the end of World War I was, quote, too foggy to fly my helicopter. How then did all the other leaders, minus Putin, manage to show up? And on that note, what is the excuse for skipping out on any, capital letters, any, attendance at Arlington yesterday to commemorate Veterans Day there? No fog yesterday. And by the way, I do believe he's the first president not to get up to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
Since, I believe, 1950 or something I read yesterday. The interesting, there was a the response from the White House yesterday was that there was he didn't go to Arlington yesterday because there was no ceremony at Arlington. And I thought to myself, the president went, I bet there would have been a ceremony.
That would have been the ceremony.
Like, I think that would have been it.
That's why there wasn't a ceremony.
Right, right.
And then we heard from Juan, who said, Hillary, 2020, how many people in this great republic did a face palm? What's a face palm?
Oh, then one of these.
Oh, face palm.
Yeah. Boom. Gee.
That was with Joe putting his palm of his hand against his forehead.
It's like a V8 kind of thing. Yeah. Oh, I could have had a V8.
Yeah, yeah. And Ms. Graber did a face palm after reading the Wall Street Journal opinion piece by two of her surrogates. Who on the panel really believes that Clinton is a liberal firebrand or that it is a good idea for her to run again? One.
I think she would probably face a lot of opposition from within her party if she would to wage a candidacy. Don't you think so, JP?
She would, but you can also see it from her standpoint. She won the popular vote. Why? Yeah. Why should anybody stop her from running?
Right. Well, nobody can stop you from running. The fact of the matter is, if you put yourself forward, I mean, how many people thought Donald Trump was a presidential material
zero,
or that he would win? I mean, that's right. So he walked down the staircase and said, I'm running, and he won.
I want to see Bloomberg run. I think Bloomberg is a really viable candidate.
Well, I like Bloomberg. I've said so on this panel a number of times and gotten a certain number of people who, you know, thought I was wrong. Okay. Okay, so Pete said...
Name names, Alan. Who was that?
Yes, what's better than optical scanners? Old-fashioned lever machines.
I miss them.
impeached.
I miss him, too.
I love that, pulling that lever and having that little curtain close and then open again.
You know, just that good.
I love it, too.
Felt like authority, like you voted.
That's right.
That sounds as you voted.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a possible user interface for a new electronic voting machine.
I wasn't,
you can emulate that.
I wasn't so sure that I was strong enough to pull down that lever. But I did my best, and, you know. Okay, Kevin. Is the Republican Party dead after Trump is gone in 2 years or possibly six? How is his base going to vote for establishment Republican in the future? Well, it's always a matter of choices, right, gang? I mean,
there are a lot of people think that there is a going to be an emergent, independent party kind of a thing. The outgoing governor of Colorado, Hickenlooper is teaming up with a Republican. He's a Democrat. He's going to team up with a Republican governor, and they're going to wage a 2020 candidacy. I mean, it may not stick, but over time, that may become a big, big factor.
We shall see, as we always say.
Of course,
say.
Someone pointed out to me yesterday that if that happens, that'll guarantee Trump's reelection.
Kevin from Melrose, 55300, and that was his. And Eric says, could there be a race more indicative of Trump's disapproval? With the whole Trump family, including the president, coming to the 22nd to help Tenney get elected, plus Paul Ryan and Ollie North as well? It would be a huge, capital letters, huge, H-U-U-U-G-E, huge rebuke of the president if Brindisi's lead holds. I am surprised by the lack of coverage locally and nationally. Glad to see Brindisi took the steps to secure the ballots because I fear shenanigans. End of letters.
Shenanigans. Okay, a couple of items have broken while we've been on the air. One is that CNN has filed a lawsuit against President Trump and several of his aides seeking the immediate restoration of Chief White House Correspondent Jim Acosta's access to the White House. The lawsuit is a response to the White House's suspension of Acosta's press pass, known as a Secret Service hard pass. The suit alleges that Acosta and CNN's First and Fifth Amendment rights are being violated by the ban. Anybody want to weigh in on that? Mike, I look at
you. Yeah, no, I think we were talking about it during the break. The fact that Jim Acosta himself can be caustic, and JP, I don't mean to out you because you didn't say
you
this on the air, but
me.
I thought his comments were that Jim Acosta should love President Trump, and President Trump should love Jim Acosta, because both of them get what they need from each other, and that is a good show.
Well, it's such an interesting concept, Mike. You know, you think about it. WAMC used to have a week and a half fun drives. Trump gets elected, and we have a day. First time ever, we make $1 million in a day. So should we say, well, good, we hope Trump keeps doing danger to the democracy because we can make a fun drive in a day?
Please, and say that's not what you hope.
It's certainly not what I hope. Yeah.
Yeah, but Acosta, you know, I think he benefits Trump in a huge way. He also, I think he does a real disservice to the media because you see all those many dozen reporters in there asking questions of Trump. They were polite. They asked nice questions. Trump, I think, asked a big variety of reporters questions where usually presidents come out and they have a list of 8 or 9 reporters they're going to call on. And now Trump gets to basically paint the entire media with this caricature of Jim Acosta.
Which is why he calls on Acosta. He didn't have to call on him.
He loves it. Yes, his third question.
But I just do want to say that it's certainly important to be respectful and to be polite. No, no problem there. But it is essential that the media challenge politicians and people in authority and question them and then come back and give them facts and throw those facts at them and have them do that.
We have a situation where a reporter has been denied access for asking what was seen as
challenging
questions,
sure.
In which other questions asked by other news agencies in the same news agency, the president said was a stupid question, and which didn't surprise him because they're all stupid questions.
And
Meanwhile, verbally attacked them. Yeah. Meanwhile, you have the Fox Network, who has personalities who are showing up at the president's rallies.
Right. Sean Hannity and Jeannie Pirro, who have shows on the Fox Network, showed up in a rally with Trump on the weekend before Election Day. They were admonished, by Fox, by the way, but to the point where their show wouldn't be on.
There was a correspondence in the press conference, though, and I do think that reporters can politely follow up and challenge the president. I remember David Gregory used to do this with Ari Fleischer and George W. Bush, and I think it's apparent to people, not just this press conference, but over and over with Jim Acosta, that he enjoys this.
Combat.
And it is about a show.
I agree.
It's not about...
But I think it's a mistake to say that reporters shouldn't challenge the president.
Right.
They should.
You're right. And again, you can politely challenge
someone.
And again, Trump called on him. And there was a reason Trump called on him.
And also, there have been times in history where there have been these slaps on the hands where you take away the press credentials and then you give them back and, you know, say,
right,
okay.
Right, but that's retribution.
And
I mean, it's really bad.
I agree, but what I'm saying, and this is a more severe case because we don't know that he's ever going to get his press credentials back, which is, and I'm sure this lawsuit isn't going to help expedite that anytime soon.
No, and I think that even the reporters that aren't the flashy ones that we all like and have affection for, we have to defend their right to be there and to ask questions. That is what the First Amendment says we have the right to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's my question. You know, isn't this an issue of the rights you have and then the way in which you behave. You know, it's not against the law to be a jerk. It isn't.
Well, I have a question.
Fran, you are so right. It is exactly right. You're protected even if you're a jerk. And maybe Jim Acosta was a jerk, but he's protected by the Constitution, and it's wrong to single him out this way.
And yet—
I would say it's not a right to be in the White House questioning the President of the United States. I would say that's a privilege that is given to reporters that act well. Trump gets up there, and most presidents have a list of 8 or 9. We're going to ask ABC, NBC, CBS.
You have to understand.
So he allowed, I think, 20 or 30
Yeah, but he doesn't
reporters.
Have daily press briefings anymore. He doesn't have regular press conferences anymore. He's ended all that. This was a show the day after Election Day. And for you to portray that as him being open with the press is...
It is open with the press. He lets anybody ask questions.
I'm trying to get in here. I never get to say a word around here. But I'm... But I did want to ask you guys a question. Can anybody here in this room imagine, take Acosta out and take somebody who he finally calls on, gets up, and is really miserable and terrible and, you know, really makes a mockery out of the whole thing and it's disrespectful. Do you think it is the right ever to take credentials away from anyone?
Well, I mean, if someone is abusive... And I don't think Jim Acosta was abusive. I think he might have been a bit of a jerk, perhaps a reference.
It's a technical term.
But certainly, if someone is abusive and they're using foul language, or they're drunk on the air, you know, there's always going to be reasons why behavior can cost you privileges. But they represent a major news organization, and to cut a major news organization, which has a huge audience of millions, out of the
especially
press
when
corps.
You've called on the guy.
Yeah, especially when you called on the guy. Well, I mean, it just seems hypocritical.
Is CNN's credentials pulled or just Acosta? Like,
no,
could they send someone else?
But you know, you shouldn't be able to pick the reporter who covers you. There's a big rule about that.
He's not. When he was calling on reporters, I watched the whole press conference. When he's calling on reporters, he says, "Who are you? Where are you from?" He has no idea where these people are from. He had people from Japan.
That's because he doesn't have press conferences.
Bangladesh. He had all these people.
All the other guys, Bush and the other guys, used to have charts in front of them in which they knew who they were calling on.
Right.
Decided to do that.
I'm sorry, JP. I don't quite understand where you're coming down on this.
So what I'm impressed with Trump is that he is willing to take questions from anybody, no matter who they are.
Right.
Okay? In there. And past presidents would have a very scripted list.
No question.
You're going to have these 8 or 9 people ask questions. So to say that because they booted Acosta that he's somehow, silencing critics.
Well, come on, JP.
A little bit much.
Well,
but
come
if
on,
he's
he
combative,
called.
I mean, okay, go ahead, Alan. Okay, I think you're called, fighting that fight for
he
me.
He called on him. For God's sakes, he called on him. He knew what he was going to get, and then he threw him out.
But if he doesn't call on him, Acosta's just going to make a scene anyway.
Oh, I don't think that's correct. I don't think it's the same thing as if you call on a guy and he asks a question. Anyway, I wanted to read something from Ilias, who said, a Pennsylvania judge outlawed the gerrymandered Congress districts. Prior to this, Republicans held a 12-6 plurality. With a very similar overhaul, vote distribution, the last election left a 9-9 distribution of seats. That's correct. That's correct. That's why it's important to have...
Right, and a few other states have voted for independent districting, so it's, that's a
this
good
is,
thing.
It's crazy. I mean, we say democracy from the people, and then we allow the clowns in the legislature to do the self-serving stuff called gerrymandering. It's disgusting. And Bennett says, Alan, he blows me out. Please remember that Mike Bloomberg maneuvered the city council to throw out term limits in order to run for a third term as New York City mayor. This happened behind closed doors and overturned term limits, which has been voted in by popular referendum. Bloomberg is a power monger. Okay, Bennett, I agree with you. I think you have to balance it. It was a disgusting part of Bloomberg's career. I'll bet he regrets it, but I don't know.
Well, I think it cost Kathleen Quinn the mayoral.
Right, and you know how he did it? You know how he did it? He bribed them. You know
Broker
how he bribed
deal.
Them? Yeah. How he bribed them? He says, okay, I want three terms, and you get three terms also. And they went for it. That's how it happened. But Bennett is absolutely right. It is a blemish on his record.
Is that it for letters?
That's all I have.
Okay, excellent.
Want me to
all
make
right.
one up?
No. No, we're out of time. So yeah. I was just checking. I didn't know if you had anything more, because otherwise we would have gotten to
it. I have no more.
Excellent. Here when, let's see, we have 3 minutes. So Google arbitration, Fran. Google overhauling sexual misconduct policy after employee walkout. This was last week. A group of employees in New York City walked out to protest the tech company's handling of sexual misconduct allegations. What do you make of this?
I think this is a big deal, and we shouldn't ignore it. It's a big deal because of the whole issue about employees being upset about this whole arbitration thing. And it's a big deal because you're seeing increasingly tech employees really saying, you know, I work for a company and I'm not crazy about what you're doing. For those of you that don't know, Google and other companies had this forced arbitration. You come up with sexual harassment. They force you to go into arbitration, and oftentimes that protects the person who is the harasser, and it makes the victim be silent.
Andy Rubin got $90 million,
you know, as he exited Rubin. He's the father of Android. He's valuable to Google, but still, a lot of people are really upset about that. Facebook.
So why did he get $90 million?
He was accused of sexual harassment in a exit settlement.
He was harassed?
He was the harasser. And he was an executive accused of harassment.
And they gave him $90 million anyway.
Right.
And Google claims other people have left, you know, without that. But to me, the really key part of this story is you're starting to see the big tech companies, you're starting to see employees rise up and worry about ethics over profit. And you saw that at Google with the
artificial
focus on Chinese censorship.
Right,
you know,
Chinese
Google's
censorship.
Going back in China. You saw that with and that Google's still doing that. But you saw that, just as Mike says, is there was a big defense contract to make to use artificial intelligence to make Warcraft more lethal. And they decided not to do that because people were upset and said they wouldn't want to work on the project. It's just really interesting to see the tech community, which is often extremely highly educated. People compete very much for these employees, and it's really interesting to see how it's actually playing out in the tech companies.
It's fascinating. Yeah. I think you're exactly right. You summed it up really well.
We are out of time. My thanks to everybody today, J.P. Miller, Mike Spain, Fran. Great to have you back.
Thank you.
I
love
Fran.
Being back. No, but I'm.
You have dates.
I have dates.
Yes,
yeah.
Excellent. So, Alan, thank you, and we'll be back right after this short break.